This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, and this is The Q Interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio. How are you? Thanks a lot for streaming or downloading or however. Downloading? However you get this. Today on the show, big music nerd talk. I don't get to do this as often as I like to, but Don Was, who is responsible for some of the greatest records of all time, one of the true iconic music producers of our time, and whether people know it or not, is like responsible for the sound of popular music. I get to sit down and just dork out with them about musicians that you know and love. And I think even if you're not as much of a music nerd, it's just fun to hear a guy who's so passionate, has let his life revolve around something like this for so long. And it's nice to hear everything he has to say. Plus, again, some amazing stories about musicians. Big Bob Dylan, Rolling Stones chat. Just a bunch of nerds. And speaking of music nerds, our good friend, as always, the Q interview producer, Caitlin Swan, the pride of Regina, Saskatchewan, is here. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan. You do well.
Okay.
Lots of people do it. Saskatchewan.
Is that a thing?
People say that, and it ain't right.
Saskatchewan.
Not that it's right to say ain't right, but Saskatchewan.
Well, feels like another thing that we have in common, because being from Newfoundland, people often say Newfoundland.
Yeah, people love to mispronounce where we're from.
It drives me a little crazy, but I tell you what doesn't drive me crazy. Listener questions.
Oh, listener mail, baby.
So you have some listener mail, or this case, I believe it's a listener DM.
It's a listener DM this time. Yep. I was scanning through all of them, and this one popped out to me because it was a hot question. Is that weird to say? It's a hot question. It's very important.
Is this a hot button question?
It's a hot button question that could end your career.
Am I getting grilled?
Yeah.
Is this what they call the gotcha?
Yes, this would be it.
Okay, I'm ready to be got.
So this one comes from Charles Pickett from St. John's, Newfoundland.
You did a great job with the pronunciation.
Thank you. I rubbed all two brain cells together to get that one right.
Well, no, but like what I mean by that, it wasn't intentionally condescending. What I mean by that is that—
Just accidentally.
I just—
For you.
That I had made a big deal out of Saskatchewan getting it right.
Yes, the
stakes were high.
Yes, you're right. Okay. So the question here is— You're on the road and you stop for a gas station snack. What's your chip, pop, bar combo?
Oh, that's a good question. So for people who aren't from Newfoundland, and I think it's only in Newfoundland that they do this, but there's this thing kind of like on movie days at school. Did you ever have movie days at school? They wouldn't teach. They would just show a movie.
Yeah. Best days of school.
Oh, 100%. We do them here at Q sometimes. So the point is—
I haven't been here for one of those days. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. The whole place takes the day off.
And watches one movie.
Paul Blart Mall Cop. It's always Paul Blart Mall Cop. And you would get a thing called a party lunch. And a party lunch was a bag of chips, a tin of drink, which is like a can of pop for you, and a bar, which I think up here they call a chocolate bar or a candy bar. We would just call it a bar. I obviously know the answer to this because it's something we talk about a lot. And, you know, sitting in bars in Toronto with Newfoundlanders, we just go around and say, what's your party lunch? It's Miss Vicky's salt and vinegar, a Twix bar, and a can of ginger ale.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an old man one because I think the cool one was like Grape Crush.
Grape Crush.
Grape Crush and ketchup chips and, you know, Wonder Bar.
Wonder Bar. Mine would be ketchup chips, Coke, Kit Kat.
Oh, how good. Choosing Coke as your
That's
drink.
That's all
is,
red, too.
Choosing Coke as your drink is like choosing Mario in Mario Kart. It's just going for the default.
It's a cult, not default, classic.
It's a Coca-Cola classic.
Exactly.
Caitlin, thank you so much. If people want to get in touch with the show and ask me a question or whatever, how do they do that?
Yeah, email q@cbc.ca.
And you can send us a note on Instagram @cbcq. You can find me there. At Tom Joe Power, but it's mainly just pictures of my two cats. As I mentioned, Don Was is on the show today. Don Was started out with that song, Everybody Walk the Dinosaur. Do you know that song?
I don't.
Someday on the floor, everybody walk the dinosaur.
Oh, beautiful.
So it's this, you're younger than me, but back in the 80s and 90s, it was part of the Flintstones movie too. It's such a silly song that you would never think that one of the guys behind it would go on to make some of the greatest records of all time by like Bonnie Raitt, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, Garth Brooks. He is a true genius of music. We spoke to him because he is also the president of the most important jazz label in music history, Blue Note Records. If you are a nerd like I am a nerd, get ready to get nerdy. Here is my conversation with Don Was. How are you?
Hey, Tom. How are you, man? Good to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Where are you?
In Santa Monica, California today.
And how's Santa Monica?
Warm and nice. I don't mean to torment anybody up north, but it's like summer here.
I'm gonna cut that out of the Canadian broadcast so I don't have riots. So congrats on 10 years as head of Blue Note. What was going through your mind when you took that job?
Well, it was conflicting. I wasn't looking for a job. I was in New York. I was producing John Mayer's album, Born and Raised. We had one night off. I went up to a club way up near Harlem called Smoke, and I saw a singer that I'd heard on the radio before, a guy named Gregory Porter.
So long, I've been needing your love.
And I just thought it was one of the best shows I'd been to. I sat there for three sets, eating ribs, drinking coffee, and I just wasn't for business. It was just made me feel good all night. Next morning, I was having breakfast with a buddy of mine, a guy named Dan McCarroll, who at that time was president of Capitol Records. And we weren't even talking about music. But at the end of the meal, I said, you know, if Blue Note Records is still a part of Capitol Records, you should sign this guy I saw last night. Now, unbeknownst to me, Bruce Lundvall, who'd run the company for 30 years and was one of the most beloved record executives ever and did a brilliant job, he was ill and he couldn't keep running the company. And they were looking for someone who could keep the Blue Note ethos alive. And he offered me the job, like right there. He said, no, you should sign Gregory Porter. And I was tormented because my whole life had been designed to avoid work. I just didn't want to lift heavy boxes. I think that's true of a lot of musicians and maybe a lot of politicians. And I was 58. I thought, all right, I did it. And I didn't have to do that. I was able to support myself, you know, playing music and making records, I felt like I got away with murder doing that. But it was Blue Note Records, and I've been a fan since I was 16. I bought my first Blue Note record I bought it in 1966. I was 14. And I couldn't resist it. So I was conflicted. I always kind of thought of the record company as like your enemy. It doesn't have to be.
I want to play you something. You mentioned 66. Just take a listen to this. So speaking of Blue Note, actually, you know what? I'm not going to say what it is. Do you want to say what it is?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's Mode for Joe, which is the first Blue Note track I ever heard. It was the first jazz I really heard. I'm sure I heard it in the background earlier in life, but it's the first thing I was ever listening to. I was 14. I was driving around Detroit with my mom running errands, and I wanted to be hanging out with my friends. It was on a weekend. And so I was such a pain in the neck, man, that she just left me in the car with the keys to play with the radio. And I landed on that song. Now, do you actually have the record there? Can you play the 20 seconds before where you started?
Do you have the cut? Do we have the cut 20 seconds before we started? You tell me why we had to go back there.
All right. So those anguished cries you heard coming from that sax in that little break, that was matching my mood as a 14-year-old being stuck driving around and running errands with my mom when I wanted to be at Northland Mall, you know, hanging out with my friends, right? And when I was turning the dial, I landed right on that section as that section came up. And it's like, what is this? But I knew it matched how I was feeling. But I noticed that 20 seconds into it, the drummer, Joe Chambers, who, by the way, is still an artist on Blue Note Records. Joe Chambers kicks in and he starts swinging on the ride cymbal. And Joe Henderson falls into line. And I thought he was saying to me, Don, you got to groove in the face of adversity. And I thought, all right, I get that, man. I'm gonna relax here. And sure enough, when my mom came back to the car, I was a nice kid again. And this music had changed my mood 180 degrees in about 30 seconds. And there weren't even lyrics or anything.
But weren't there exciting? Wasn't it exciting as a music fan in Detroit in the 60s? Like, wasn't there?
Oh,
I mean,
man.
Wasn't there Motown and early?
Joe Henderson was actually a Detroit musician, even though he's on Blue Note Records. A lot of the Blue Note roster came from Detroit. But also, you know, I'd go out to clubs, see the MC5 and the Stooges and the Amboy Dukes with Ted Nugent. That was like the house band at this little teenage club right behind my house. I could hear him play every Friday night. Motown was there. It was great, great soul R&B scene, great blues scene. John Lee Hooker was a local guy.
Great. John Lee Hooker was a local guy?
Yeah. I mean, he started working in the auto plants in 1948.
And Seeger, Bob Seeger, I talked to Alice Cooper recently, and he let me know, and I didn't know this, but I didn't know he had like a garage rock band in the 60s in Detroit too. Like, he was a rocker.
They were badass. I saw him play, Bob Seeger in the Last Herd, I think is what it was called. And they were great. I saw him play with Teagarden and Van Winkle at the John Sinclair Freedom Rally in 1970 with John Lennon on the bill. Saw Bob. Bob's like, he's the Bob Dylan of Detroit, you know. He's the poet of the ethos of the city, I think, you know.
I want to play another song. Take a listen to this.
The woodwork squeaks, and out come the freaks. Yeah, the woodwork squeaks, and out come the freaks.
So from 1981, that's Was Not Was with Out Come the Freaks from their self-titled first album. Dom Wass is my guest, who formed the band with his childhood friend David Weiss, who became David Was. So hold on. So explain this to me. So
yeah.
I know that Was Not Was came out of what you were hearing in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess Motown, MC5, kind of the long, the blues. I guess funk. Funk was happening. Jazz was happening. How did all this come together to make that?
Well, I wasn't like a teenager then. I was probably, you know, I was like 28 when we made that record. And so I'd been playing on records and playing around as a musician. So I knew a lot. I like Larry Fratangelo, who did all the percussion on One Nation Under a Groove and played live with Funkadelic. He's on that record playing percussion. Marcus Belgrave, who a jazz trumpeter, who was the most important jazz musician on the scene, actually, in Detroit, played with Charles Mingus and Ray Charles. He's playing trumpet on it. Wayne Kramer from the MC5 is playing guitar on that. And so it was just kind of an amalgamation of the jambalaya of of the milieu that we grew up in the middle of. That's all we were really trying to convey, I think. In subsequent years, I ended up working with some of the best songwriters ever, you know, Bob Dylan, Willie Nelson, Keith Richards, Kris Kristofferson. I guess it's probably Brian Wilson put me over the edge working with him. Every time I sat down at the piano, I thought, well, what's the point of me writing a song when these guys are all out there? And the way I finally overcame it was to realize that great as they are, I'll never be as good as them. But on the other hand, they didn't grow up in Detroit in the 1950s and 60s when the auto factories were booming and all these cultures were coming in with the workers and everything was colliding and there was real excitement and all these hybrid forms of music were happening. So I thought, just be who you are. It was an incredible time to grow up in an incredible place. Detroit was just alive culturally.
I just want to play a little bit of Walk the Dinosaur. Just take a listen to this.
Okay.
So, Don, I'll be honest with you. I didn't know until, like, I know your work pretty well from, I know your records very well. Incidentally, like, the records you've made have meant something to me, right? You know?
That's
like,
very nice.
And I knew that song because that came about, that got another sort of life in the early 90s when the Flintstones movie came out and they had it in that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was you until I got ready for this interview.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
I was going to ask because it feels like I'm always nervous to play those kind of songs, even just big hits for people. What's your relationship with that song now?
Well, it's ever changing. What I hear now, you know, Sweet P. Atkinson, who was the lead singer on that and was one of my closest friends for 40 years, he passed away early on from COVID, I think. And I just, when I hear it now, that's all I can think is I'm glad that he lives on in these recordings, but I miss him a lot. And so that is now replaced what was a really bad memory, which was that in 1989, that became a hit first in England. And we went on a TV show and all of a sudden it jumped up in the charts. And we had the opportunity to be on Top of the Pops, which would have made it a top 10 hit. But because of some kind of labor laws, we had to leave the country for 10 days and then come back to get new work permits so we could be on Top of the Pops. And they sent us out on a tour, but we weren't really on tour. We were lip syncing the records. And they're sending us to like clubs to lip sync the record on the dance floor. And all we did was stop the flow in the club. So we met hostile reactions everywhere. And we're standing there moving around without our instruments plugged in. And it was so humiliating.
Right, because you guys, coming from Detroit, you guys know how to make a club move. Like, you can do it.
Yeah, we can do it. Yeah, but we didn't have, you know, they weren't putting us on tour at that point. It was just kill 10 days and make enough bread to, like, cover your hotels. And it was just awful. And I can't get past that. That ruined that song for me.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about Bob Dylan and Brian Wilson and the Stones and all that. But given that this is a Canadian show, I reached out to a good buddy of our show, Ed Robertson from Bare Naked Ladies.
Oh, there we go.
Because Maroon, the record you made with B&L, was a really, really big record, especially here in Canada. I want to play. So I asked Ed if he would give you something and ask you about something. Take a listen to this.
When I think about making Maroon with Don Was, I think about how present he was, sitting in the center of the band through every pre-production rehearsal and every performance on the record, in the studio, like not in the control room, in the live room, sitting in the middle of the band, completely immersed in every performance.
That's Ed Robertson from the Bare Naked Ladies.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you first, how does it feel hearing that?
That's beautiful. He could have said a lot of things. I'm glad that's what sticks out.
That's not a production technique you hear a lot. And I think even like listeners who would listen to this, who would think about what a producer does, would think about them sitting on a couch or sitting at the control board, you know, directing, giving some notes. I've worked with producers who all they do is go, uh-huh, or no, the idea is that's kind of it. Talk to me about immersion there before we start talking about your production.
Well, just as someone who played on records, when everyone's in the same room, there's air moving, you know, and you feel that physically. And that's part of hearing what's going on naturally. So it's really important to hear what the other musicians are hearing and feel what they're feeling and actually get the physicality of sound waves hitting you in the chest. And what the energy is like when the band's playing, because then you go back in the room to listen to the playback. And if you're not feeling the same thing that you know is there, then you know you got to fix something. You know, there have been times when I've worked with engineers and I see them messing with the EQ on the drums automatically. And they're trying to change things. I said, well, have you gone out there and listened to it? Listen to what the instrument sounds like first. And then try to capture that and then see, maybe you don't have to do all this. You don't have to reinvent the sound. Maybe there's a great sound out there. So it's really important to sit at the source. Also, there are just some practical matters. You know, there's a glass between you and the band. So if you talk, you have to reach over and touch a button and hold it down and then you can't hear them. It's much easier to communicate if you're sitting in a room with everybody.
When did you figure this out? When did you figure out that you might be able to be a good producer?
I knew really early on. I think it was probably like when Sgt. Pepper came out. And that was the first record I can think of, which was, whatever, 1967 or something.
You said I could do that.
Well, no, I became aware that the studio techniques were being used as musical elements.
Yeah.
It wasn't just documentary where it's just to capture what's happening. Now the studio and the microphones and the outboard gear, they're creating textures that have an emotional and a musical impact. and I became fascinated by that aspect of it. How does the technology in the room become another musical instrument?
I want to play a song right now.
Okay.
Bonnie Raitt from 89 with Thing Called Love from her album Nick of Time. Don Was, producer of that record. Don Was, president of Blue Note Records. Don Was, my guest right now as we nerd out a little bit about music. I got to talk to Bonnie about this record, and I wanted to ask you about it.
Mm-hmm.
She told me she wasn't in a good place personally or professionally when she came in to do that record. What do you remember about going into those sessions with Bonnie?
Well, she was probably in better shape than she was 2 years before.
Right.
I felt very fortunate to meet Bonnie at that moment in time. I'd been a fan since her first record. We're pretty close in age. So I was in college and when her first album came out, and I was just blown away by her. So she was always a favorite of mine. But when we did Nick of Time, she had been sober for like a year and a half. And I think one of the things that happens when you get sober is that whatever emotions you were trying to drown out with drink and drugs, you have to find another way to release that. And in her case, it made her a much better artist and made her able to write a song like Nick of Time. So I thought she was in great shape. She was incredibly clear and she sounded, you know, she sounded better than ever, and she'd written some deeply personal songs, and that I think is therein lies the mojo of Nick of Time. You know, it's that she was a woman who was about to turn 40 and decided to write about turning 40 instead of, and not just about turning 40, but of being mature and not accepting mistreatment in relationships, being strong, standing up for herself. But also being vulnerable about what women that age go through, which had been anathema in rock and roll.
Yeah, there were no records for people above over 40 in the late 80s that didn't exist.
No, if you were 40, you tried to pretend you were 18.
Yeah.
And the record companies saw to it that you did. So it was brave for them to put that out. And Bonnie was just trying to be real and get these feelings out of her and out into the universe so they wouldn't be trapped inside, you know. And I think unbeknownst to anybody was the fact that that the audience had matured with her and they were really happy to have someone singing about what it means to be 40 years old as opposed to just singing about cars or, yeah, you know, teenage things. And it just resonated way beyond our expectations.
can we play something to talk about?
Let's give them something to talk about. How about love?
So this is a bit indulgent for me because that's a bit of a recent like rediscovery for me. That's one of those songs that I heard on the radio a lot when I was a kid. And then it came on in my list of my speaker in the kitchen the other day, and I felt that you can't help but dance a little bit. Like I was just doing the dishes and I was moving and dancing. Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to play it for it is also, mm-hmm, not just what you had to do with it, written by a Canadian.
Yeah.
Shirley Eichardt.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a great song. I don't know that Bonnie knew her personally, but she'd sent a cassette and it was like at the bottom of a box. But Bonnie is a pretty thorough, she does thorough research. She listens to everything. Also, she's a very profoundly deep musicologist with a lot of knowledge. So she listens to all kinds of stuff. And that just came up. You know, she probably listened to 300 cassette demos that weren't happening. But that one was just like, wow.
Did you know too? Did you know that one would take off?
I knew it was really good. Shirley's demo was great. And you could imagine Bonnie singing it. Between that and I Can't Make You Love Me, which is also on that album.
Unbelievable.
I think we knew going in that we were okay. Because it's hard to follow. Nick of Time won the Grammy for Album of the Year and sold like, 8 million records or something like that. And that's that could put a lot of pressure on you to have to follow that up. But when we had Shirley's song and I Can't Make You Love Me, I think we knew that it was going to be okay.
Hope you enjoy that show, product, place, or service, or dog grooming facility. Here's more of my conversation with Don Was. Here's my question for you. So you work with people like Elton John and Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, there's one thing I know about you is what a fan of music you are and how you grew up loving these people. How do you produce their music honestly without having a preconceived notion of what they should sound like based on your affection for their previous work?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point.
I don't know.
I know, it's a really good point, and it shows that you have a profound understanding of the process, because that's a real thing at the core, because I think you got to be a fan and you got to believe in the artist and you have to trust their instincts. That's if you're producing a 19-year-old or the biggest band in the world. It's tough. Like, I think I failed Bob Dylan, to be honest with you, on Under the Red Sky.
There was a little boy and there was a little girl.
Because in the back of my mind was a preset notion of what Bob Dylan was supposed to sound like based on what he'd done in the past, exactly as you expressed it. And I was trying to steer him into that. And he had no desire to go there. And I wasn't listening to him. There was a moment, the very first session, the assistant engineer ran a DAT tape of everything. So every word that was uttered in the studio, we had recorded, which I said, give me that. We can't have that floating around. But I did listen to part of it while I was driving back home from the first session. And in it, Bob was explaining something that he wanted to try. And I was telling him why it wouldn't work. And I had to pull over. Man, I wanted to throw up. I thought, man, this is your hero. You waited your whole life to be in a studio with him. And now you're not even willing to trust his instincts enough to try this thing he's suggesting. And in retrospect, I realized he was trying to go to something new, but I was fighting him and I vowed never to do that again.
So what do? You just try to go zen with them and just try to accept whatever they want to do and try to...
I'm willing to chase up a terrible idea for 3 days and on the chance that they know better than me, which is always the case. You know, if you're not willing to do that, you shouldn't produce the record. So I'll go down a manhole with someone and I'm usually surprised. You know, usually something happens. If it's not exactly what they talked about, we land on something else, which leads us to something else. And that's part of the fun of it. So I learned to be a lot more open-minded and trusting and not to just recreate stuff that happened already. What was the point of pushing Bob Dylan into a position where he's recreating Blonde on Blonde? Yeah. That's like the dumbest thing, just because that's a stupid fanboy thing that's got nothing to do with actual creation. And that's recreation. It's like cartoon world or something like that. So I put a lot of value in creating something that no one's ever heard before.
Yeah.
That's a really noble thing to pursue. It kind of goes against the conventional wisdom of pop music marketing. But if you really think about it and look back on everything that was innovative, whether it's Charlie Parker or the Beatles or Prince, whatever, you know, they all absorbed the foundational roots of what preceded them and mastered them and then took that knowledge to create something brand new. And that's the music that lasts. That's the stuff that you listen to 40 years later.
Yeah, what David Letterman says, you can't subvert what you don't understand.
That's really good. I never heard that before, but that's really good.
I'll take 10%, Don. Don't worry about it.
I'm writing that down. You can't subvert, but you don't understand. I love that.
Isn't that great? Yeah. How's I'm a bluegrass guy. I grew up playing bluegrass music, so I'm a really big Bill Monroe fan. For people who don't know, Bill Monroe is the father of bluegrass music and also just a really weird guy. And and someone said to me the other day that everything Bill Monroe does is a Bill Monroe story. If Bill Monroe goes and if someone saw Bill Monroe get coffee, that's a Bill Monroe story. I think it's the same thing with Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
So tell me about working with Bob.
Well, I'll tell you, I haven't got anything bad to say about Bob. He's always been really nice to me.
Yeah.
And I've learned a whole lot from him, not just about making records and music, but about life. You know, I mean, there's a song on Under the Red Sky called Born in Time.
In the lonely night.
And when we were doing it, I didn't quite get what it was about. And I knew better than to say, "What's this about, Bob?" But I thought, "It's like Born in Time for what?" You know, what's it? And then about 10 years later, I don't know where I was, but I got this notion. I understood the idea of a universe where there was no time, where time is not relevant. It's just relevant on Earth. And then I realized, born into the world of time. So I called him up like really early in the morning the next day. I said, "I got it, man, Born in Time." And we talked for a couple of hours and he turned me on to a bunch of books that really changed my whole way of looking at life. So he's been great like that. He's well-read. He's super smart. He's everything you want Bob Dylan to be. And he's also funny. You know, he's like the sessions have always been fun with him.
I've heard that from everybody that he's really funny. Yeah. He's a funny guy.
Yeah. So I enjoy him. Yeah.
He left me reeling with his feeling.
Can we play some Stones? Can we do the song he get to them? From your most recent Rolling Stones album, Blue and Lonesome, that's the Rolling Stones of Just Your Fool. Don Was is my guest. What do I want to ask you here? I kind of want to ask you what it's like to record with the Stones, but I also know we just lost Charlie Watts.
No. Yeah. No, that he was such a remarkable character, man, because he didn't play hard. He played like a jazz drummer, and he had his arms down his side. He didn't waste a whole lot of unnecessary physical motion. He put it into the thing. It sounds like he's playing so hard. You listen to him, you think he's like a muscle man, like Kenny Aronoff with the tank tops and the and he's ripped. And he's just this refined guy. But for some reason, there were a couple of things about his playing that no one could figure out. He was a really enigmatic musician. He had this ritual before each song we record where he'd hit the drum with the tuning peg, right, to tune the snare drum, say, and he touched the pegs, but he'd never turn them.
What?
It's like some weird little ritual, you know. It's like doing a cross or making the peace sign. He'd hit all the pegs, but not turn them. But no matter what key the song was in, the drum was always in tune.
Whoa!
There were little things like that that were so mystifying. The first session we did was for an album called Voodoo Lounge. And on the very first day, he started playing. We were getting the drum sound. I said, "Man, maybe we should change the head on the snare drum." And the room got like super quiet. And this was 1993. And he hadn't changed the head on his snare drum since 1978. It was the same head that he used on Some Girls. And it was on every tour that they'd done, every record and every tour that they'd done since Some Girls. And he hadn't changed the head. So it was really like asking him to give me, you know, his appendix or something. he was shocked and no one ever had the nerve to ask him. And I was just too ignorant to know not to ask. And he changed the head.
He did.
Yeah, he did. It sounded great too. Then he totally got into changing heads and doing different things. But he was kind of superstitious about not changing anything.
I like, for people who don't know anything about the drums who are listening to that, like even if they don't understand what changing a head of a snare is, It tells you a little bit about Charlie. It tells you a little bit about the kind of guy he was, you know?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people think he's a raw kind of drummer, but in 96, we're doing an album called Bridges to Babylon. Mick was always looking to make it more contemporary, right? So we thought, let's make some loops out of Charlie's drums and apply some hip hop techniques to someone. Just try it, right? So we put on the Chronic, Dr. Dre.
1, 2. Bring it to the folks, Snoop Dogg.
And he just pumped it through his headphones. And we said, just play to this album. And he played along with the Chronic, and he never flammed once. It was perfect. He had metronomic time, and he was locked in the entire time. And I didn't realize he had the chops to do that. Very few people can do that.
But back to the lecture at hand. Perfection is perfected, so I'm gonna let him understand.
The flamming, for people who don't know, is if there's a snare drum on the Dr. Dre record and you hit a little bit behind, flam is like hitting not at the same time.
It's kind of onomatopoeic. It sounds like flam, you know?
He never flumped once, you know? He was completely locked. He had the chops to do anything, but preferred to play in a looser fashion. And he knew exactly how far you could push it before it would fall apart. One of the things that makes the Stones such a great band is that everyone feels the beat in a slightly different place in that band, but they're not so far apart that it falls apart, but they push it to the limit. Charlie embraced it all and held it together. It's a subtle thing, but he's such an important component of that band and such a great musician.
Beautiful. Yeah. Don, I want to go back to Blue Note in a second, but before I do, I've been wanting to ask you this question the whole time.
Okay.
So when you work with, like, again, Brian Wilson, Bob Dylan, Bonnie Raitt, Paul Westerberg, Garth Brooks, I mean, I could go on and on and on, like Kris Kristofferson, Willie Nelson. Having worked with so many genius level musicians as you have, do they all have anything in common?
Yeah, they have so much in common. Yeah. I mean, I used to feel that, I still feel this way kind of, but the image I always had was that there's this great creative ether floating way up in the sky, right? And when the ideas are there, you sort of reach in and whatever lands in your hand, you pull down. But all the good ideas are like floating at the top of this ether. And very few people have tentacles long enough to reach all the way to the top and get the good stuff.
Yeah.
And all the people you mentioned have the long tentacles there. They all understand that it's something that's moving through them. It's not their idea. They don't really have ownership. One time I asked Bob Dylan, I said, how come you can write Gates of Eden and I can't? And he said, well, if it makes you feel any better, I didn't really write it. He said, I remember moving the pencil over the paper, but I don't know where it came from. It came through me. And to a man, everyone that you mentioned there will say the same thing. Keith Richards never says, I got a great idea, hold it. He'll always say, hold it, incoming. So they are vessels.
So is that nature? Ideas. Is that nature? Is that something divine? Is that God? What is it?
I wish I knew, man. If I knew, I'd maybe get more for myself. I don't even know where to go shopping for it.
I don't even know where to go shopping. But yeah, I guess it has to be there.
That's the mystery of the whole thing. That's what makes it beautiful. Like every time I go into a studio, I don't care if it's for a 19-year-old kid making their first record or the Stones who've been doing it for 60 years, I'm nervous. I get butterflies in my stomach because I know something cool will happen, but you never know where it's going to come from. It's a little like surfing. You know, you can learn how to get up on the board and how to stay up, but you don't control the waves at all. You got zero control over the ocean. So you just wait to catch that wave and you never know where it's going to come from.
Well, that's what, I mean, this is you as a label president now. I got to talk to Jack Antonoff. You know, Jack, incredible. And kind of the Don Was of, I mean, you are the Don Was of right now, but he is putting out a lot of hit records right now, which are are good records too, right? Taylor Swift,
great records. Lord, yeah, fantastic.
His own band Bleachers. And I said that to him. I said, we had sort of a similar conversation and he said, that's why I don't blame label people for trying to make it happen again. That's why I don't blame them from taking all the best songwriters and performers and putting in the room, or taking all the, giving people songs, go write something like this. Because of course they're financially invested. They're going to try and control something that really rarely happens.
Yeah. 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 It's kind of pointless. I try to tell everyone, just do anything except what you did yesterday. but yeah, I like the idea of an album like Bitches Brew. When I first heard that album, it's Miles Davis' album from like 1970 or something. And when I first heard it, I didn't know what they were doing. I dug it, but I didn't know what was happening to create that. And the beauty of it is that no one did, including those musicians. That style of music didn't exist until they laid it down. The day before, that music was never heard, never existed. And that's a great thing to strive for. Do something that nobody's ever done before. That doesn't mean it should be bad art. Good art is communicative art. Doesn't mean it shouldn't be generous. Generous music is where you feel something deep inside and you bleed to get it out and to give it to someone else in the hopes that they're going to receive that and it'll help them make sense out of their lives, or at least entertain them for 3 minutes at the minimal, you know. But maybe you can actually help people make sense out of a life that makes absolutely no sense. So you got to do all that, but do it in a way that no one's ever done it before. That's music to a true artist's ears.
Yeah. Well, on that, let's play one more clip before we go. That's When It Was Now from Terrence Blanchard's 2021 Blue Note album, Absence. I got to talk to Terrence a couple of weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago now, about the opera, A Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And the thing we talked about was largely about, like, the stories opera hasn't been telling, mm-hmm. and the stories that opera got to tell. And it made me think about you as Blue Note president, because you're not just custodian of a legacy. You are also helping steer a ship for the future of that storied record label.
Yeah.
What stories do you want Blue Note to tell?
The truth, you know, man. It's like this. I just want people to tell the truth. But, you know, when I first got the gig, yeah. I'll tell you, I was woefully unprepared to be the president of a record company. But one of the things I knew I had to do at the very beginning was really figure out why the music of this label, which has now been around 83 years, why if you put out an album that's 60 years old, it still sounds relevant? You know, why the catalog still sells, why people are still interested in this stuff? And what were they doing in every era? And I found a manifesto that the founders of the label wrote in 1939, and they really dedicated themselves to the pursuit of authentic music and to providing unlimited, uncensored expression for the artists. All right, well, that's good, man. Because how do you reconcile a label that's got Nora Jones, Van Morrison, Wayne Shorter, and Robert Glasper on it? What's the common link there? The common link is that any one of them can step up to the microphone and tell you the truth about their inner emotional lives. And it doesn't matter what modes or scales you use. That's really at the core of that music. So inherent in that mission is the notion that you can't tell people I don't know what the stories are. Tell your story, man, but just tell it well and tell the truth and dig deep. And those are the artists we're interested in. There are some You know, when I worked with Garth Brooks, this is really when I realized this.
Was this the Chris Gaines record, or was this the...
It was indeed the Chris Gaines record.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
The first session I did with him, he stepped up to the microphone and he started singing.
There's no more waiting, holding out for love.
And think, imagine like the line where the speakers are as being like the 50-yard line at a football game. So that's the speaker line. Most people never cross that line. The big stars jump out a little bit. Garth jumped out so far that it sounded like he was almost behind me. I was like, oh, now I know why he's the biggest recording artist in the world, which he was in 2000. That's just some crazy gift.
I played every field, I suppose.
Mick Jagger's got that. Aretha Franklin's got that. You know, I got to record with her one time. And, oh, yeah, of course she's. It's a great way to measure artists. John Coltrane's got that. Miles Davis has got that. That their voices transcend. It's being audiogenic. You know, it's like a fashion model. Claudia Schiffer
photogenic.
Is photogenic, yeah, because she jumps off the page and gets your attention. And then you look at the page and you find out that she's wearing those jeans and you want to buy those jeans. So audiogenic is leaping out of the speaker. And that's something they can't teach in school. It's a gift that you either got or you don't.
Let me close off like this, and I could talk to you for 8 more hours. This is exciting. We always end the interviews with a song that we get the artist to pick out. And typically I say to them, like, I typically go to artists and I'll say, like, you know, from your album, your new album, this is the single, that's the single. What's a song on the album you wish had a little bit more love? Mm-hmm. So let's go to the Don Was, like, production and artist discography. Can you go through for a needle in that haystack and pick a song for us to play?
You know, I'll tell you, it's just one of my favorites. It was one of my favorite sessions of all time. The Willie Nelson singing Across the Borderline. I was kind of auditioning to make a Willie record. And they flew me over. The Highwaymen were appearing in Dublin at the Point Big Amphitheater there. And so I went over and we took them into the studio, Windmill Lane, to cut the song that we had to do for a movie. And that was my audition. And we cut it in like one take, and we're all set up. And Willie said, all right, you got another song. So I played him Ry Cooder's version of Across the Borderline with Harry Dean Stanton singing that last verse.
Calling you across the borderline.
And we talked about the meaning of the song. He said, all right, let's go do it. And we worked it up, and it's one take. And when as we got to like the second chorus, I was thinking, oh, please, nobody mess this up. It was just extraordinary. It was just floating. It was just perfect. And I just knew we had a big fish on the line. So we go into the control room and he says to the engineer, who's just a kid who was the staff engineer at Windmill Lane in Dublin. He said, I just rolled this joint here. And he takes out a Sharpie and he puts a little blue dot 3/4 of the way down. He said, I'm going to start smoking this. When it gets to the blue dot, your mix is done. and you know, you have the records that you're proud of. You have the ones that you know were hits. But what are the ones that you want to play for yourself to make yourself feel good? And that's right up there at the top of my list.
Don, lovely to talk to you, man. Thank you so much for making the time.
Great to speak with you, Don. Thank you, man.
Very cool to talk with Don Was about the sort of why of production in addition to the how of production. Like, the how is obviously so interesting because, you know, you get to hear about these stories about Bob Dylan and Bonnie Raitt and all that. But the why of it, like the way he sees music, is always really, really interesting to me. I love nerdy music dudes. And Don Was is among the nerdiest. Was, by the way, I was calling him Don Was the entire interview. That's me. They're not going to keep me around much longer. If you have any questions for the show, drop me a line, q@cbc.ca. Don't forget to hit subscribe and rate and review. Thank you so much for listening if you made it to the end. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.